Hi, my name's Gary Anderson.
And I'm Randy Tonks.
And we're psychology instructors here at Camosun College, and today we're going to talk about epistemology. So let's start right out. What's epistemology?
Epistemology is all about knowledge and knowing. Traditionally, epistemology is the study of what knowledge is. So, you know, what is it when we know something? But not only that, it gets into where does knowledge come from? And how do we go about justifying knowledge or theories of truth?
Now, what do you mean by justifying knowledge? You mean if I believe something, do I have to, like, justify that or rationalize that to other people or myself?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we look at epistemology generally, what we come up with is that we generate ideas or thoughts or suppositions. And then what the next question is we ask ourselves is, do those correspond or relate to reality? And when we ask that question, we're getting into the realm of truth. And so if I have an idea, but it's completely fallacious or imaginary, then we could say it's not true. But if I have an idea that somehow relates to a greater system of ideas or to some external reality, then according to at least those two different theories of truth, we could say that it is true and is a justifiable idea.
Okay, so truth is not necessarily reality.
No. Truth is a link between reality as we can appreciate it or understand it and whatever knowledge we can glean from that reality.
Okay, so what we're really going to talk about on this show then is maybe not, is just a little bit of epistemology, right? We're going to talk about how do we know what reality is? How do we know what's real?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things that I talk about in my introductory psychology class is that I say, well, if we look up in the corner up there and we see this huge big green monster, and I say, God, there's this huge great big green monster up there. We better get out of here. And I run out of there. And everybody thinks I'm crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But if they all look up in the corner and say, hey, there's this great big green monster up there. And I go, I don't see any big monster. And they run out. I'm still crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter whether I see the monster or not, because it's the definition of reality depends on everybody else, not on me.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, if we look at it in that sense, we're getting into what we might call a social consensus notion of reality and truth, and for that matter, craziness. That's a whole other ball of wax right there.
Right.
But certainly, that's one way to look at what methods or means we can use to understand reality and truth and knowledge as well, and that's the social or the social construction of reality, if you will.
And is that the most widely accepted approach in psychology, would you say?
In psychology, no. I think that typically psychologists orient themselves towards a form of epistemology or of knowing that we call empiricism. And empiricism as a form of knowledge or epistemology is the theory that suggests that all of our knowledge comes through sensory or other experiential experiences, primarily sensory though.
So that if I do see a big green monster up there and nobody else sees it, then the sociologist would talk about the social construction of that reality because it's not really there unless everybody else agrees that it's there. But a psychologist would say, if I see it, it's real?
Well, generally speaking, yes. The assumption is that the senses as an apparatus that delivers information from the external environment to our brains, which we presume is the seat of our consciousness, is believed to be the pathway there. And so that if the senses are giving us that information, either the senses are giving us the truth or somehow they're faulty in their operation.
Okay, so that's why psychologists are so interested in like illusions and hallucinations.
Yes, precisely.
Because that's our senses are faulty?
Yeah, I think it shows some of the limitations and some of the operations of our senses when we look at illusions or hallucinations, because we can come to understand that the information that we gain through sensory experience is not always what we might call veridical or corresponding to some sort of reality.
Well, When we're talking about this, I remember a series of books from the 60s and the 70s by Carlos Castaneda, which were extremely popular and quite controversial, because there was some question about whether the experiences he described were really real or not. But he did use this as the basis of his thesis, mm-hmm. his PhD thesis at UCLA in anthropology. And he was studying with a Mexican brujo, or a medicine man.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some other apprentices as well. And they would use various kinds of drugs like peyote, and then they would have these experiences that they would share together.
Mm-hmm.
And the question always came up constantly is, well, did you really fly? Did you really fight to the death with this woman? What about after the drug wore off? Was she really dead? And mm-hmm. were you in the same place? And he always kind of tiptoed around, or kind of got his way out of confronting this question.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm asking is that his senses are being influenced by the drugs, but for him it's real.
Mm-hmm. Well, one perception is that perhaps drugs or other sorts of means, meditation or things like this, fasting, may allow us to see reality in a truer sense than what we would normally do. And this is one of the big age-old questions is, reality is something. We make assumptions about what it is or isn't, and that's when epistemology comes in, because our theories about what reality is are dependent upon certain other assumptions about what knowledge is. The trouble is that when we think about reality, we think about it within our own experience, and we have to bring in other assumptions that, number one, our senses are working functionally, or number two, we're hallucinating, or something else is going on.
Right. So I thought of a couple things while you were saying that. One was, I was a research assistant for a while for a man named Richard Alpert, who mm-hmm. he's now become Baba Ram Dass.
Uh-huh.
And he was, working with, Timothy Leary at Harvard.
Yes.
And they turn on, tune in, and drop out. The assumption being, as you said, that using LSD to turn on, then you would tune in, you would actually see what the real reality was. And once you saw that, you would drop out of the game or mm-hmm. the normal social setting, because that wasn't real.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And this idea is not one that begins in the 1960s with LSD and Timothy Leary's studies there, but is a very ancient idea that goes back to people like Plato, for example, within the Western tradition, but also within other traditions such as in India. The Vedantic tradition is one that gives rise to Hinduism and Buddhism in more recent forms. And one of the key ideas within Vedanta, for example, is that our everyday experience is filled with what they call maya, or illusion. And so the reality, within quotation marks, that we experience in an everyday sense is thus seen not as reality, but as illusion. When in fact, the belief is, or the knowledge, depending on which system you're adopting, tells you that the true self, the actual reality is well beyond that. And certain special means are required to appreciate and to understand that reality beyond what our normal everyday illusions provide us with.
And so what would those special means be, say, in the Vedantic tradition?
Within the Vedantic tradition, the special means is a form of meditation, but it's not just meditation, sitting down, gazing at your navel, going om or something like that, but rather careful and systematic discrimination of thoughts and ideas, and trying to find the roots of them and what ideas and thoughts can be, potentially at least, in their connotations, their denotations, and so on and so forth. And over years of systematically examining thought and consciousness and trying to whittle away, if you will, like an onion skin, all of the illusions, one ideally is left with pure thought, which, as the Vedantics describe it, has no form or content. It is pure thinking.
So this is, nowadays some people talk about this, like they've taken this idea and call it like mindfulness.
Yes.
Or the hidden observer, where you watch yourself as the actor, and then you judge and you, make decisions as an outside person about what you should be doing and what you're thinking, so that you can evolve to a higher level of consciousness, let's say?
I think so, yeah. Within the Vedantic system and many other forms of thought that are associated or developed from it, there's a notion of the true self. And in Vedanta, it's called the Atman. And the Atman is that pure consciousness, that pure experience, which brings us back to empiricism, ironically. But it also recognizes that the senses is not what gives us that pure experience. It's something deeper within our body and mind. That is the pure thought or the pure consciousness that's at the seat of all living things. So not just human beings and perhaps animals having consciousness or this pure being, but all things are believed to have this sense of conscious awareness at one level or another.
So as a Western psychologist, how do you reconcile that tradition with the psychological empiricism tradition?
Very delicately. At times, they, I think, appear to be absolutely incompatible, but I think that in many ways that when we look at some of the elements that come out of this deconstructive way of thinking, if you will, from the Vedantic tradition, where we're trying to break down our thoughts and ideas and try to understand the foundation or the basis to them, we see many of those kinds of ideas in Western philosophy as well. For example, Descartes, who was interested in reality and truth, that he wanted to know what was the ultimate foundation, because he thought that perhaps his senses, for example, were tricking him. And if he was walking down the street, and how would he know whether all of the people that he thought were people were not merely robots, and that some very cunning and deceiving God had not just placed them there to trick him? So he tried to deconstruct or trace back to what he could really trust. What is the foundation of his knowledge? And from that basic foundation of knowledge as he understood, he then built a system or understanding of reality as he understood it based upon that most basic assumption.
But there's lots of ways that he could have gone wrong.
Certainly.
For instance, one of the other things I was thinking of about this is a book, A Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, where a woman is hospitalized in a mental hospital and basically escapes from the mental hospital by creating a whole nother world in the future that she then lives in. Mm-hmm. And at some point it becomes real and mm-hmm. the hospital world is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, are they both real?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it depends on who you ask. If you ask a typical modern realist, who is somebody who believes that there's an objective reality that somehow lies out there, usually seen as a material reality that is made up of physical material objects, and that's the source of all our knowledge, they would certainly say that this other world is unreal. But within Western and Eastern thought, there are long-standing traditions of what we might call subjectivity or subjective knowledge. And this, in many ways, is what Descartes was getting at with his cogito ergo sum argument, that I think, therefore I am, and that those thoughts, in having them, is the basis of reality. You simply cannot deny that you exist if you're having thoughts. And so what many people from this tradition, and some of them go back to people such as St. Augustine and others in more contemporary times, come to recognize is that the personal subjective consciousness or understanding is real to that person and has to be taken as such. And Carl Jung, the great psychoanalyst, was one who very clearly identified this, that when you're dealing with someone who others may call delusional, you have to deal with those so-called delusions because it's an absolute reality for that person. And this is what we call the subjective approach, which looks at the world through the experience of the subject or of the individual experiencing those things.
Right. Okay, so I want to ask you about that a little bit.
Okay.
For instance, one experience that I had, I was training in hypnotherapy in California to become certified as a hypnotherapist in California. And one of the things we learned seemed to be very similar, when to use it in therapy, to what I had learned when I was working in the 60s. I volunteered to help talk down people who were on bad LSD trips.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we did it, our philosophy was that you entered into their trip as best you could,
mm-hmm.
and then you talked them back out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of was one of the methods that I was learning in hypnotherapy, so that what I was trying to do is make my reality stronger than their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I also worked at a school for really severely emotionally disturbed children, mm-hmm. where the philosophy was basically the same. This was a really interesting school run by a man, a psychoanalyst, actually, a psychiatrist and analyst, who had been in the concentration camp and survived the concentration camp. And as the director of this school, his philosophy was that people should be allowed to make choices, even these kids who were, quote, really crazy. And these kids were extremely disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that we had volunteers who would intrude on their life just gently and become part of their life, and then draw them back to our way of life out of the world that they seem to be living in. And one of my jobs for a while as a trainer was to make sure that the volunteers didn't get sucked into the child's life, because sometimes that happened.
Certainly.
And I've also run into that in other settings where you've worked with emotionally disturbed kids. Some of the workers were a bit psychologically fragile, and they would end up in the child's world of the child's reality, I guess.
Certainly, and then that becomes their reality as a result.
Right.
Yes. I think that's interesting that you bring up the concentration camps, because Viktor Frankl, another famous psychoanalyst who also was a survivor of Auschwitz, and I think he was also in Dachau, he wrote about, and this is a commonly and widely understood phenomenon, individuals in the camp often would recognize other individuals whom they would see as being ready to drop dead. And there is a Muslim term at the time, I can't recall the exact word that they would use, and this Muslim term literally meant dead in 3 days. And what Frankl recognized was that for some people, their subjective reality was of giving up hope and life, and that they literally thought there was no future for them and no way out of their circumstance. And these people, literally, in spite of having the same amount of food and conditions as the person in the cot next to them, would literally be dead in 3 days. At the same time, others that had hope and that their reality or subjective experience led them towards a more positive orientation somehow made it through not only that day, but the rest of the war and managed to survive, much like Viktor Frankl himself.
Right. And so, yeah, that's a book that when students are introduced to it, find it very powerful, Man's Search for Meaning.
It sure
excellent.
Is.
And I guess his point there is that your job is to find what the meaning of your world is,
mm-hmm.
and that there isn't meaning in the world as an abstract thing, but each person searches out their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't find it, then you're one of the people that would die in 3 days.
That's right. That's right. And it really is that finding meaning or meaning making that is, I think, quite central to human being. And really, that's what epistemology is all about, is meaning making, finding meaning within what it is that we know about reality and the world around us.
Well, I have another more contemporary example that's quite controversial,
mm-hmm.
although the controversy seems to have been slightly resolved now, but false memory syndrome and mm-hmm. allegations of sexual abuse. And one person says, you sexually abused me. The other person says, no, I didn't. Both people have a very clear, solid memory of it. There's no corroborating or outside evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so many therapists have said that you have to accept that as reality.
Mm-hmm.
And other therapists say, no, you don't have to accept it as reality, but you have to accept it as their reality.
Yes.
So, how do we, resolve this? Where do, epistemologists come down on this?
Yeah, this is a really sticky one. And within, as you say, the controversy of recent times, this is one of the biggest controversies, I think, that we've seen in some time. And I guess ultimately it goes back to the early days of Freud, who really developed the theory that from which these ideas have emerged. But I think there are a number of different things going on here. One is individual health and happiness. And in that sense, I think we have to look at the individual meaning and reality at one level. But on the other hand, there's a number of legal and ethical issues at hand here. And that if indeed there was some sexual abuse, then some legal measures need to be taken. Now, courts of law don't like to base their judgments upon hearsay or individual reality, and there's this pressure for some external corroboration, as you say, or some external reality.
Right. And so, like, I know at the APA, this has become a big, the American Psychological Association, this has become like a big dividing point between people who accept whatever the client brings mm-hmm. as reality, and people like, say, Elizabeth Loftus, who is doing research into the fallibility of memory, and saying that you can't accept people's reality because it leads to conflict with other people's reality when the realities aren't the same.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, this controversy that it has been somewhat isolated within this area of psychotherapy and the creation of false memories really is the tip of the iceberg that we all have to face, is what really is reality and whose understanding of it are we going to believe?
Yes, sometimes my wife and I were having a discussion, and sometimes we have different memories of events that we were both present at.
Certainly.
And she has come to realize that she has this impressionistic memory of sort of the feeling, the attitudes, the atmosphere, but not the exact precise events. And I sometimes remember all the little precise events and details and everything, but misremember what the actual emotions over the situation were.
Certainly.
So it's quite interesting. We both seem to have accurate memories, but it's not of the same thing.
For sure.
Even though it's of the same event.
And I think research has shown that just because we may be very confident in our memories, that doesn't mean we're very accurate.
Oh, right. Yes, there's no relationship between our confidence and our memories and whether we're right or not.
That's for sure.
Okay, so there are other ways in epistemology of knowing what's right. For instance, mm-hmm. there's tradition,
mm-hmm.
and there's dogma, mm-hmm. and there's authority.
Yes.
Now, maybe we should talk about each one of those, because there's a long history of those other ways of looking at what's true or what's reality.
Mm-hmm. I think that those three in particular stand somewhat close to each other, insofar as over the years there's often claims for truth and reality simply because it is tradition, or that the traditional authorities are the ones recognizing it, and this is the dogma. And many instances throughout history, I think, can be identified as places where this has come to be recognized as seriously problematic. One that I've come to look at through my readings in philosophy of science is when Galileo, for example, developed one of the first telescopes and observed empirically the moons around Jupiter. Well, he was told by the authority, by the dogma, and by the traditions that this was absurd, and that the authority, coming from Aristotle and the Catholic Church at the time, suggested that there were only seven heavenly bodies, and there could not possibly be more than that. And so further, they interpreted his experiences, and even when he handed them the telescope that he had developed and saw things through there, they interpreted those experiences as this little machine that multiplies images. There weren't more images, or there weren't more planets. There were just more images in the scope.
Right. So you could take that on either side of the UFO argument, even mm-hmm. to the people who have been captured by UFOs and taken up and impregnated, or had autopsies done and brought back to life,
mm-hmm.
that the worldview, lots of people see UFOs where the other person looking doesn't see it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a belief system with an authority figure, I'm thinking of, like, I'm leading towards, like, Heaven's Gate.
Sure.
And the cult. And their belief that there was a spaceship coming direct to rescue them. But you couldn't see it because it was hidden behind the comet, the Hale-Bopp comet. But when the comet went by, the spaceship would veer off and come down and rescue them. So they had to be all dead wearing their red tennis shoes in order to be rescued.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on the authority of the leader.
That's it. And it was reality for them, but unfortunately reality for them, as it turned out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning the conflict between Galileo and the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And so one of the things that comes up frequently in psychology classes is, you know, science versus religion.
Mm-hmm.
And we started this talking about empiricism, and basically that's the basis of the scientific method,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you try to be objective, you try to be public with your observations so that other people can replicate them or test them and see if they're true or not. Mm-hmm. And you rely only on the data. You're not allowed to just, you know, make up things in mm-hmm. your head because it sounds like a good idea. So how do you reconcile, say, papal authority and the Pope? And the Pope says, this is the way it is, and this is true, because he has a direct pipeline to God who made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. There's a very interesting relationship between science and religion. And science, I think, rather ironically, really emerges out of Christianity as a form of knowledge. And looking at people like Francis Bacon, for example, who used the Bible as justification for why scientists should go out and take dominion over the world, because God gave us the right to do so. But aside from that, essentially what scientists and Christians do is rely upon different criteria for establishing truth. As you say, scientists, typically natural scientists, use empiricism or the senses as a way of acquiring knowledge. And they rely upon something called the correspondence theory of truth to establish the truth or the justifiability of those ideas or observations that they develop. So this correspondence theory of truth is a theory that says ideas are true if they correspond or match with some external reality. Now, the trouble is we're always stuck inside our observations or the observation box, our head, our skull, and we can never get outside of that to corroborate whether or not that reality is somehow beyond. So what we end up doing is we look to each other to say, well, did you see that inside your experiential box as I saw it? And maybe we use words to batter around, and we hope that the words we use are describing the same thing, but we can never be completely sure. Now, the fact that we can never be completely sure that what my experience is the same as yours, and if you want to push empiricism to its extreme, how do I even know that you're really here? You might just be part of my imagination or my dream. We may not go there today, but let's entertain that for the moment. In facing some of these challenges, a number of philosophers have come to reject the empirical theory of knowledge and the correspondent theory of truth, and instead turn towards what we might call a rational frame of knowledge and what we call the coherence theory of truth.
And which would be?
Well, the rationalists, Plato, Descartes, many others along that same tradition, suggest that rather than turning to the senses to find truth, we need to use the power of reasoning. So careful thinking, deduction, perhaps induction, but using our minds to carefully examine our experiences and tear them apart to see what is truly there. As Plato identified that the senses are a vehicle through which we can get glimpses of reality, but they mask reality. And of course, he used the metaphor of the cave, that when we use our senses, it's as though we're looking at shadows on the wall, and we assume that those shadows are reality. But if we use our reason carefully enough, we can come to understand in his metaphor that those shadows are really being created by other objects. And those objects themselves have been created by something else, and reality is well beyond. So it's through the careful use of reasoning that we're able to, in a sense, understand how it is that our senses may elude us back to that notion of Maya, and how it is that we can get beyond that by truly understanding what's going on.
Right, which brings us back to, almost back to the social construction of reality that if we agree, then it doesn't really matter, right? Mm-hmm. Because we just behave in that way. It's only when we disagree on what reality is that all these problems come up.
It sure is.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. This is a thorny issue.
It sure is. Thanks, Gary.